Welcome to The Indigenous Approach, a podcast where we examine the role of the nation's premier partnership force across the competition continuum, from cooperation to conflict and everything in between. In this episode, we are honored to have Medal of Honor recipient Sergeant Major Matt Williams and Medal of Honor recipient Sergeant First Class retired Melvin Morris sit down for a discussion about what it means to serve in the Special Forces Regiment.
Welcome, Sergeant Major Matt Williams, currently with 3rd Special Forces Group, and have the pleasure of sitting down with Sergeant First Class retired Melvin Morris, Medal of Honor recipient from Vietnam, served in multiple different SF groups, which I'm sure we'll talk about in depth here shortly. But I was going to give Mr. Morris the floor a minute and introduce himself and tell us a little bit about himself, and we'll go from there.
Thanks, everybody, for letting me speak. My name is Melvin Morris, Sergeant First Class. Retired, sent multiple tours to Bragg and Green Beret. We'll talk about our history later.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll get deep into the history. One of the highlights I wanted to kind of talk to you about, and again, I'll say first of all, honored to be a part of this. It's been awe-inspiring for me to get to meet so many recipients and now sit down. It's kind of a candid conversation, especially kind of amongst Green Berets. I think it's an awesome opportunity, so I look forward to that. But really, just kind of want to talk about a few things. The name of the podcast is Indigenous Approach, and nobody embodied that approach of working with Indigenous folks like our Vietnam-era Special Forces guys, and you being one of them. I was wondering if you kind of talk a little bit about what it was like working with your partner forces there, leading up to kind of your receipt of the award, and the actions taken that day, and just overall in general of how you guys did things back then.
Well, I think what I do is kind of hit on my history. I first volunteered for Special Forces in February of 1961, and was selected and transferred to a group in March of 61 and went to SFQC. Back then, it wasn't called SFQC, but it was did have a qualification course. During that time. And once you selected and signed the MOS, you were assigned to an A-team.
Right.
And it's sort of like OJT. And you did your skill training. Took about 2 years, at least for me anyhow. Then you get your final test.
Yeah.
And the team got to accept you, and the CO got a write-off mark off on you.
Right.
And that's the most important thing. You couldn't get your Special Force qualification until you spent that time with the team. And I was qualified in 1963.
Okay.
So can't forget the date, because that was a great day, September 12th, 1963. And so I say, well, when we had the Green Beret back then, you had a little candy bar. And part of the flash was cut off.
Right.
And that meant you weren't qualified.
Okay.
So you didn't like that.
Right.
You wanted the whole flash.
The whole thing, yes, sir.
Yeah. So when you got your, it was called the S identifier back then. Once you got that, you got the whole flash. So you had an identifier back up your MOS. And it was the 12 series back then. So, I spent all that time, and we had what we call the White Star Mobile Training Teams. 6 month deployments, but I could never grab one. I wanted one so bad, so bad. Because you train. And if you don't deploy, you just say, my training just went to waste.
That's right.
I want to go. I'm ready. That was before Vietnam. That was during the days of Laos and some of Vietnam, which wasn't publicized. And I waited. Eventually, I got transferred out of group because of my behavior in 1964. Long story, But I was on Captain Roger Donlon's team before we got the Medal of Honor. And I got injured, and I had to get reassigned. And I was really upset because my two buddies got KIA on that team. And I weren't there. But I'd rather be in KIA with them. That's how tight we were. Right. And that's where USF is.
That's right. Yes, sir.
And so eventually I had to volunteer to get to Vietnam. Before Vietnam, I spent a year and a half in Dominican Republic. After the Dominican Republic, got back to group, went to refresher training and a training group, reassigned volunteers for Vietnam, and finally got to Vietnam, and it was 1969.
Wow.
I mean, think about it. People were running away from Vietnam. I'm volunteering.
That's right.
I wanted to go really bad, so I finally got there. And I was assigned to the Detachment B-55 Mobile Strike Force. And you know the history of the Mike Force. I used to say hunt and kill. But really, they were designed to help out the A-teams that were on the A-camps. If they got on the heavy attack, our job was to go in and beat the enemy off, rescue them. When we weren't ready for that, we were always trying to engage the enemy. That was our job, engage the enemy. So if you want combat time, you go to Mike Force, you'll get it. So I spent about 9 months with the Mike Force before I got wounded in action. That was 1969 September, where our team had actually we walked into a major ambush, fortified positions. And I don't think that we were expecting that kind of resistance.
Right.
Which, use the proper words, I think we kind of let our guard down a little bit. And once the shooting started, we took a lot of casualties. My team sergeant got killed. I was bringing up the rear, so I came up to the air aid. And, of course, you don't leave a brother behind in SL. I had to get his body out. I had to make sure the wounded was evacuated. We had three Americans, well, two wounded, one KIA, within an hour to get into the area operations. The intel sergeant stepped on a landmine. We was injured very bad. A team CO had got into part of ambush with the team sergeant. He was shot three times, I think three, four. He got in a fight near him. Now, I guess they were beating him with a baseball bat. It was tough.
Yeah, wow.
But I was able to get him out. He didn't want to go. He didn't want to go. But I said, Captain, you got to go. So I got him out and went back in to recover team sergeant body. And I took two in with me, and they got wounded. Took them back out, and I had to go back in again. I didn't have to, but my job is to do it.
That's right.
So I went back with some more volunteers, and we got hold of his body and dragged him out. And it was kind of like a lull in the firing or the fighting. And his map case come out. And all team sergeants, sergeant majors, they carry a map case with all the goodies in it. And I had to go back and get it because I knew what was in it.
That's right.
The SOIs and all this. And once I went back in, I went back in with my interpreter to pick up the map packet. And the enemy shot me right in the chest. And I took him out going down at my interpreter. He was out of there. And so now I'm by myself, and I'm shot in the chest. So I got to take care of myself. So I back up against a palm tree and checked out my wound, and I knew it wasn't a sucking chest wound. So I said, I can live through this if I cover the hole in my chest. Mm-hmm. That's which I did the best I could. while I'm doing this, they're still shooting at me. And I had one hand grenade left. I threw that at one of the enemy, got shot in the hand, got back behind the tree. I got shot in the arm. A lot more to the story. But I was in there for, seemed like hours.
Right.
And when I ran out of ammunition, I said it was time to go. And, but I had instructed my SF assistant, if I went down, for him to move out and leave me, because he was the only one left standing. And he followed my instructions. So I knew that I had to catch them no matter how far they had moved. And I just said, forget the bullet holes, you can make it. So I started to run. And I don't know how far I ran. I always try to guess quarter mile, half a mile, maybe a mile. You know, when your adrenaline is pumping, you don't really know. And I finally caught up with him and got medevac. You know, that was the action for the day. And I never thought anything about it after that.
Right.
And I was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross for that action in December, April of 1970.
Okay.
But at the same time, I had volunteered to go back to Vietnam. So I had, I was at the parade getting a Distinguished Service Cross and my orders for Vietnam in the same month. So I was on my way back to Vietnam. And when I went back to Vietnam, I went back to the 5th. And I went to Command and Control North, Mac V. Sock, and a recon team leader. And I survived that one, which is kind of tough to do.
Yes, sir.
But, you know, that's part of my history with SL. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we need to know a little something about you, though.
Well, my history doesn't even begin to touch on it. You know, you mentioned that's your history of SF, and it's funny because that is, you know, that is basically the history of SF, right? You guys back then, Vietnam, as you mentioned, the Mike Force and the Mac V. SOG, and I mean, you guys are what we look up to and train after even to this day. You know, and so it's amazing to be able to sit here and just hear those stories. You know, for me, I joined the Army back in 2005, out of college. You know, it was, you know, shortly after 9/11, and that's kind of what drove me to do it. You know, I had that will and want to serve, kind of like you mentioned, like you knew you wanted to go to Vietnam. You know, and I'm assuming because somewhere inside there you thought it was the right thing to do. You know, serve your country and things. So that was my decision. That's what drove me to do this as well. And I signed up to be an 18 X-ray and join the Army and try my hand at Special Forces, and you know, made it through the course, and assigned to 3rd Special Force Group here at Fort Bragg, and done 5 different tours to Afghanistan, and you know, I was awarded the medal a little over a year ago for an action that happened in Afghanistan in 2008. So there's a little bit of break similar. I was awarded the Silver Star originally, and then it was upgraded. Definitely not as long as a break as yours. You know, I think mine was about 10 years. I think yours was about 44.
But I was, excuse me, I didn't mean to cut
you off. No, sir.
But I was here 2015.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. When you had the Silver Star, I mean, I've talked to some of your team members about you being upgraded, trying to get you upgraded to the Silver Star.
Yeah, is that right?
Yeah, I remember that well. And really, I kind of like didn't pay attention to it. I was going to ask you, were you the one that I knew that was going to get upgraded, were trying to be upgraded? I didn't really know until I was coming here.
I don't know. It's so, you know, myself and Ron Scher, who passed recently, but was my medic on the team, and his was upgraded as well. So overall, that team, that mission in 2008, the Shock Valley had 10 Silver Stars awarded for the mission itself. And then 2 of us were upgraded eventually within the past couple of years.
You and Ron.
That's right.
Yeah, Ron was my good buddy.
Yes, sir, yeah.
I was with him the last time, and he told me, Melvin, I'm at stage 4.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hate to hear that, but
yeah,
only thing I can do is just pray for him, you know.
That's right, yes, sir, yeah.
Yeah, but I remember him talking about you. So I thought I had met you before, but I can't remember.
That's possible.
Yeah.
I heard you do. You travel a lot, so I'm sure you've met plenty of folks.
Yeah. But, you know, I never dreamed that I would be an SF soldier because I never thought I'd fit.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not how you fit. It's how tough you are.
That's right.
It's how committed you are. It's how you want something. You know, where you're willing to sacrifice to get there. And I guess that's what kept me going because I was in and out of group like a ping pong ball. But, you know, I was determined because this is what I wanted.
Yes, sir.
And that's what makes us up, soldier. We're all not perfect. That's right. Understood. But, you know, I'm so proud to be around any SF soldier, Green Beret or whatever. It's because people just don't know the quality of the person you're talking to.
Yes, sir.
It's a lot, yes.
No, I tend to agree. You know, I think everybody that eventually, no matter how many times you try, how many times you get after it, you know, the ones that make it, you know, they make it for a reason. It's because of what's near, and it's what's in their mind, right? That's what gets them through. What really drove you to want to be an SF soldier?
A country boy from Oklahoma. that
makes sense.
It's kind of been hunting, fishing all my life.
Yes, sir.
In the woods all the time. And I was in the 82nd Airborne Division, Division of Artillery. And somebody said, well, SF is accepting applications. You got to put your 1049 in. That's what we call it back then. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm going to put in for it. And the guys in the barracks laughed and say, ain't no way in the hell they're going to take you. So you're 18 years old and you're 5'4", 126 pounds. Yeah, they want real men. But I say, heck with this. I put in my paperwork.
Yeah.
And we went on a jump into Panama, come back, and my paperwork's approved. And I end up on Smoke Bomb Hill.
Yeah.
That's when they had the wooden barracks. And I say, once I was there, I said, I'm going to stay here.
Yeah.
And I struggled in and out from 1961 to 82. But I was determined to make it. So I never did quit on anything.
Right.
Never did quit. And I often thank myself for that. That no matter how hard the struggle gets, you keep going.
Yes, sir.
When you can't get up, you fall face down, that's the only time you quit. And that was a philosophy I used.
Well, I mean, I'd say it worked out pretty well.
Yeah, it worked out.
You're still sitting here talking about it. So.
Yeah.
You had plenty of reasons to quit. Shot 3 times out of ammo behind enemy lines, and you know that no quit got you here today, so I think we're all happy for that. I was gonna ask a couple, you know, just in general, you know, things have changed a lot over the course of years, obviously within the special forces community, but I think, you know, a lot of it stayed the same. We rely on our history, and that's what we learn from. How do you kind of see that? Are you with the way things are now and the way things were back then, you know, do you think SF's in the right path? Where do you think we should be going with what we're doing?
We went through two or three different changes. When I first came in, SF was strictly working with unconventional warfare.
Yes, sir.
Training, advising, assisting, directing.
Right.
Troops. We never thought about direct action, even though we were trained to better than any soldier in the Army, as far as I'm concerned. But it was mostly unconventional warfare. So we spent a lot of time on training missions, deep in the bush, unconventional, and then moved on. But I understand SF's going to move back toward that direction, which is good. It's harder. I think it's harder.
No, you're right.
Because you'll spend more time away from home.
Yep.
But SF is, to me, extremely hard now, extremely difficult. They never move backwards. They're always moving forward. And with me being around the other forces, I still put SF at the top of the spear. There's nothing better.
Yeah.
And it gets better as it goes along. The only thing that I see is just wish more people like me were in SL.
Yeah.
When I came to SL, I tried to recall everybody that I knew that was African-American. And I can't get past one hand.
Yeah.
This was an entire group. Because when we came over from the 82nd Airborne Division, and it was 31 of us in that group, that we were, four of us left, we're still together.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and we often talk about what can we do to convince more minorities to go for the 18 series, go for the 18X.
Yeah.
When I'm out on the road a lot of times, I tell them to volunteer for the 18X.
Yeah.
You know, we need you. We're not diverse enough. And it really, the only thing that I can do is keep encouraging them and try to get them educated. Is it fear or what?
Right.
But you only fear for yourself. You know, and I try to talk them into coming into SL because we need to be diverse.
Yeah.
The world is changing.
That's true. Yeah.
The world is changing. And, you know, if you want to be with the best and you want to do something tough, volunteer for SL. And that's what I tell them.
Yeah.
You know, I was talking to my friend. A lot of them, well, they'd rather take the time thinking I'm going to be a pro football player than going into the military.
True.
But no, go into the military and volunteer for SL. Volunteer for Ranger School, Navy SEALs, whatever.
Right.
But this is your country. This is my country. Do whatever you can, but just don't take the easy way out. Go the tough way. Go the hard way.
Yeah.
And so the only thing that I can really say is continue. I'm going to continue doing what I do.
Mm-hmm.
Is when I'm able to talk to minorities, I tell them, volunteer for special forces. That's it, bottom line. And I'll have to continue to do that and encourage everybody else to do the same.
Yeah.
Because I think it's lack of knowledge about the Green Beret. They don't have them, the family background, the history.
Right.
That helps. They don't have the people to talk to them. They don't know anyone.
Right.
And if you look at the junk they have on TV, it'll change anybody's mind.
Yeah.
You see, so we got to get them in. I got to get the information that's real world information, not television, not going in kicking down doors and shooting everybody.
Yeah.
You know, that's not SL.
Right.
Yeah, so it's lack of knowledge and a lack of someone reaching out. And, and we need more people to reach out. Probably to bring the minorities in.
Yeah.
We're in changing times. It's going to have to happen. You know, I'm going back to my experiences way back. One thing that we did lack in 82nd Airborne Division and in the Special Forces, we didn't have officers a minority.
Mm-hmm.
Our officers, we didn't have those in leadership positions. They were few and far in between. And, you know, sometimes it takes the person the same minority to be able to talk to somebody else, you know, even to understand, put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so not only reaching down to the level of the enlisted man is going to 18X, we need officer volunteers. They're not volunteering, as far as I can see.
Right.
You know, and so we got to get them graduate from college, go ahead and hold your hand up, go in the SL. We need you.
Yeah,
and especially you know with the warrant officer program,
mm-hmm.
I thought that was the best thing since bubblegum. That's a retaining the experience that you got in SL. But you know, it's most of them we're not going to have the minorities wearing becoming warrant officers. I know the ones that have so far,
mm-hmm.
and but we need leadership at the top. We need diversity at the top, as well as the bottom. So we have to, it's an ongoing process of trying to figure out how do we bring more minorities in.
Yes.
From all races.
Right.
From all races.
Agreed. Yeah. I think that's probably the toughest part in general is it's understanding the way to communicate effectively, you know, across the population, and then compounding the youth, the way that the kids are brought up today is making it even harder.
Yes.
You know, it's that wanting, the willingness to want to do something hard is, I think, it's kind of going away, unfortunately. And it's, I think that message is, was, you know, gold right there. I think that kids in all walks of life need to understand that. No matter where you come from, no matter how you're brought up, no matter what you have, what you don't have, you know, that willingness to want to work hard is what it all boils down to.
Willing to do something better and higher, then you can set your goals really high.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, you know, you go do something like the Q course or volunteer for a ranger school or volunteer for something hard, and you accomplish that goal, then it makes everything in life much easier.
You know, don't have a fear of not graduating or passing or whatever. Fight for it.
That's right.
Fight for it. Just like I said, the 31 of us, everyone qualified back then.
Yeah.
And everyone is passed on except four of us.
Wow.
And we're still true to ourselves right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. And so, but we try to get the word out. We talk often about what can we do to try to bring more minorities, make ourselves more diverse.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard.
Yeah.
It's very hard, and they have to understand that it's not going to ever be a given going to SF.
Yeah.
So that should make you proud if you can graduate from SF.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, I guess that is one of the biggest things is understanding that, you know, the pride that comes with, you know, earning the Green Beret, it's not something you can explain to somebody. It's something, you know, until you kind of feel that, you know, when you really, you're done, you graduated, you earned your beret, it's not something that can be replicated.
And that's why I like to get out and try to recruit.
That's right.
It's not a given. You just don't come and say, I want to be SL.
Yeah.
It ain't going to work that way. And it gets harder as it goes along. I try to stay in touch.
Mm-hmm.
And I ask myself, do you think you could graduate now? You know, and I won't answer that.
Yeah. I mean, I got to say that you absolutely could. I mean, again, like I said, you, if nothing else, you got the no quit mentality it takes. So that's been proven time again. So,
yeah.
You know, and I think that's a good point. You know, SF needs to be all encompassing of everybody. We need all kind of people from all different backgrounds because we all bring something to the table.
We all bring it to the table.
You know, I grew up similar to you, small town, you know, kind of, I'd say country boy from Texas, hunting, fishing, things like that, but with the world, the way things are going, you know, we need kids from the cities. We need kids that are smart on computers and doing all that kind of stuff. You know, as much as we need the outdoorsmen, you know, kind of guys. It's definitely evolving in that aspect.
Yes. But let me. I want to stop for a minute. I read your bio, right? You know, I'm good at that. I don't remember. And really, your bio reads something like out of a movie. What work that you were doing toward the Medal of Honor, or what you had to go through, put it that way. And what drove you like that? I mean, you and Ron both I talked to him about what he did.
Yes, sir.
But now I can hear you. Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think for me personally, it was, I mean, in general, it was my upbringing. You know, I was taught from a young age to that, you know, you don't quit. Kind of like you mentioned several times, and I think that's kind of the underlying theme that we'll see is that mentality is kind of the number one thing to be successful in this community. And that's how I was brought up. You don't quit. You know, do the right thing with strong kind of a strong moral and you know upbringing. And that's what drove me to serve originally. Was I knew this was the right thing to do. You know, I love my country, and we were in between history at that point when I was a kid. And then we had ourselves an issue to deal with being, you know, the terror attacks on 9/11. So you know, that kind of drove me to serve. And that's always just kind of been in the back of my mind. But then that day, ultimately, you know, when we found ourselves in the position that we were in, ambushed on the side of a mountain in Afghanistan with, you know, facing relatively overwhelming odds due to the terrain and the way that things were laid out, everything else kind of went away, and there was the only thing that was for sure going to happen in my mind was that all my buddies were coming off that mountain and all going home, dead or alive. At first, we found out everybody was alive and everybody got home alive, which is a blessing on its own. But similar to like you mentioned earlier, you know, we're taught and never leave a fallen comrade, right? That's ingrained into you early on in your Army career, and it's really it's a specific focus in the Special Forces community because of the work that we do. Being behind enemy lines and kind of out there on your own, and in your situation, three or four guys, and your team sergeant gets killed, you got to go get them because you know what's going to happen if you don't.
Yes,
and that in the back of your mind, that's not something that. Me personally, that's not something I'm willing to live with. So that's, I made the same decision. I think, funny enough, as you did, was, hey, we're getting these guys, and it doesn't really matter what it takes because it's going to take everything it needs to take, if that makes sense. So, you kind of bring that up, and I think that's funny. And I kind of wanted to ask you the same question, was what drove you to do it? Was it something that you just inherently have, or do you think you kind of learned that and were taught that in your Special Forces training?
Taught that in Special Forces training that, it's kind of like an unsung rule, but now it's a rule.
That's right.
We don't leave no brother behind.
Yes, sir.
Irregardless of the situation. Yeah. And we just have people say, well, what if you can't get them? We don't use that word, can't.
That's right, yeah.
We can't. And right now, we sell like 1,500 possibly POW MIAs still unaccounted for.
Yeah.
That's one of the main reasons. Families can never have closure.
Yes, sir.
And the enemy loves a trophy.
Mm-hmm.
And we experienced that with a Black Hawk Down, yeah. Remember? They will mutilate Americans' body or do everything else. We don't want that.
Right.
So, bring out buddies home, could be alive. You don't leave them.
Yep.
You go in and you do what you have to do. Actually, when you get a SF soldier, you start the fight. You don't know what you got yourself into. Mm-hmm. 'Cause we're going to get him back.
That's right.
If possible.
Yeah.
And that's we live with that now. And I think it's the right thing to do.
I agree. I think it's kind of part of it's part training and part kind of the brotherhood that you form with your team. You live and work with these guys for, months, years at a time, and they're your family, at a point. And that's the way that I looked at it, too, is, I was new to the team. I've been on team 3-4 months at this point when my action happened, but still those guys are my family, still keep in touch with them to this day,
yeah.
And that's a bond that I don't think that people quite can understand that really can't be built anywhere else. And that's one of the values of our community, of the Special Force community, is that, no matter what, we're still, you have Green Beret, I have Green Beret, then we're immediately family from that point forward.
And we're going back to, I was listening to General Ola Myers the other day, SF legend.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, never seen nobody get upset because he can't go back into combat.
Yeah.
But that was him. But he mentioned something about character. And early on in the days, they told you that you're going to have to fit into the team.
Mm-hmm.
And if you there and they don't like you, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
But you all got to be a family. You got to be one. You mentioned that. And everybody's character basically is just about the same.
Right.
Because you're going to operate independently of each other. And the way SF perform, you operate from 2 to 12.
Right.
So it's important to be a family, be trustworthy, be dependent on each other.
Yes, sir.
Have the same character. I think that's what keeps the bond going.
Right.
Yeah. A lot of changes, okay, some or not, but you deal with them.
Right.
There's always a way around them anyhow.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, and that's kind of what I was kind of getting at when asking you about, how things were for you, and how you see things are today. And I think that the point is, you kind of said, things change. The mission sort of changes and the atmosphere changes and the technology changes, but ultimately SF guys, Special Forces guys, still do. We do the same core mission over and over again, and we have for forever. You know, I think that's something really to focus on is how we get overseas, where we go, who we work with, and how we work with them is really key. You know, I was going to kind of ask you a little bit about that, and specifically to your situation. You know, everybody's heard the story of the Montagnards. Everybody's heard the story of the Vietnamese partner force. Is there any kind of highlights you have from working with those guys, stuff that you learned that you kind of take with you?
Well, something different with me and something didn't. I didn't have no problem. I had Cambodians in the beginning. And in fact, right today, my radio operator still talks to me. He's still alive.
Is that right?
Yeah, we still communicate with each other. You got to establish the same bond.
Yeah.
But I didn't gift them out or try to buy friendship or nothing.
Right.
I treat them like they belong to me, and they knew it. They knew it. I didn't play.
Right.
And the bond grew. It was mission time, but you're an advisor. No, I'm not an advisor. When I'm out there in that bush and things go down, if I had to take charge, I'm taking charge. And that's the way I operated.
Right.
And I let my Cambodians know it. We had a Cambodian commander, but if he wasn't doing the job, somebody got to step in.
That's right.
And they knew that. But they looked up to the American Green Beret if they were treated right, you know. And I kept them, I treat them just as I would American soldiers. And I really enjoy working with them.
Yeah.
But do it again today.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. I think that's one of the funnest parts of the job when it boils down to it is getting over there working with those guys. Like I had the pleasure of working with the Afghan commandos a couple of different times. And it's the same situation. There's a relationship understanding there that everybody has to know. And you said yourself, if you got to be out there and take charge, then you're going to do it. And that's the same situation that we were in early in the Afghan war. You know, and I think it's still that way today. But the highlight of it was that, you know, they're ultimately our partner, and we work with and through them. We're training them and to do what they need to do in their own country, and they see the value in that. And they understand what we're there to do. And that's really how you build that bond. And like you said, you know, still in contact with these guys
actually
today.
Help us achieve our objective.
That's true, right.
Yeah, there's one thing that I did learn. I never forgot. I can't remember what year. Studying about working with indigenous people is learning their values, learning their mores, learning their customs. Mm-hmm. You know, treat them the way you want to be treated, but don't break their rules.
Right.
And we get along fine. So, like you said, I enjoy working with them because you feel like you're accomplishing something if they are doing what you taught them.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and we're kind of seeing that now where, you do, like you said, we had the working with the indigenous folks, we kind of moved a little bit towards the direct action, you know, mindset and shift, and now we're that's kind of dialing back, and we're getting back to our roots, you know, kind of find out, right? History repeats itself, as they say. So, you know, I think it's important that we understand, you know, where you guys came from, what you guys did, what you guys learned, and how you guys worked, because that's something that we, you know, are going to continue to have to learn from. You know, we're not doing anything new, and we're not trying to reinvent the way we operate. We're getting back to our roots, and that's why I think there's such value in this conversation and, you know, the ability to sit down and talk to the guys like you that did it from the beginning. You know, that's extremely important. So as you mentioned, I was talking about, you know, the length of your award. You're awarded the Distinguished Service Cross originally back in, what did you say, 1970 or 69. Mm-hmm. You know, and then 44 years later, you get a phone call. And it's one of the most interesting setups to a phone call ever. I can speak from experience. I was going to ask a little bit about that. How all that happened for you, especially being, you know, disconnected and out of the military for so long.
Being away from the military for so long, you know, you get a phone call from Department of Defense, Department of Army. I told my wife, I said, you know what, something's wrong with this. You know, when you ever have top secret clearance. You it's in there.
Right.
You reach that point. You're told to keep your mouth shut.
Yeah.
And I was telling them, I say, well, who's going to call me the Man in Black? Because, you know, I said, did I say something wrong? I
right.
Say, are they going back and find something that they ready to put me in jail for or what? You know, because I didn't have a clue.
Right, yeah.
And I was very curious, and she told me, well, you got to be by the phone the next day. And I worried. And I was by the phone 12:30. Colonel Davis called. And he says, the day before I talked to him, he says, a high dignitary that want to speak to you, a very important person, and you need to be by the phone tomorrow, 12:30. And I said, now, this is the colonel I'm talking to.
Right.
Now, higher than a colonel, higher than a general, right. I'm not thinking. I said, this is, you know, I just couldn't put it together.
Right. And you've been out of the Army for so long at this point.
Huh?
And you've been out of the Army for so long.
I've been out of the Army for eons. Yeah. In fact, it was 30 years.
Yeah.
And something by the phone next day, and a phone call came in. And I answered. And the colonel says, Colonel Davis, and that's a very important person standing by to talk to you. I said, yes, sir. Put my phone and say, well, this is President Obama. And I almost fell out. I did. I mean, I was scared in the beginning. Now I'm at shock.
Right.
And he said, I want to apologize to you for not receiving the Medal of Honor 44 years ago. Yeah. And I'm informing you that you're going to receive the Medal of Honor, but I need you to do me a favor. President going to ask me for a favor? Yes, sir.
That's right.
And he said, keep it confidential until you get official notification. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Okay. I told my wife I wasn't satisfied with that. I got to find out more. Somebody pranking me. Give me that. I will find the number.
Yeah.
If he can't find the number, I said, I'll find the number. I managed to find the number to Colonel Davis' office.
Yeah.
I called him up. He chewed me up and he chewed me down. He said, anytime you get an official call like that, you don't doubt that. You know, I was really thinking somebody pranked me.
Yeah.
So I got my butt chewed out, and now I got to wait 10 months. That's how long it took, months. And I didn't want to cut the grass no more. I didn't want to go to the store. I didn't want to go anywhere. I said, I got to wait this out, so I'm not going
to actually say something.
Right. And so it's fine. It took 10 months.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, but I had a lot of thinking to do. And in fact, I was so paranoid when they came to the house, you know, the military, and I had interviews and stuff and talked to me. I was sweeping my house for bugs. I didn't even trust them. But it was a good time. It was a hard time, but it was horrific because, you know, your mind is flipping and flopping, I'm going to tell you. But you know, once I reached that day, you know, I really felt different about it,
yeah.
You know, and you accept it because I didn't really know how to accept it,
right?
You know, and then and you will tell yourself, well, I didn't think it was worth the medal or what it is,
yes, sir.
You know, but you know, so here we are.
That's right. Yeah, you know, it's funny. That's kind of that's why I like to bring that up because I think you know the Army has its way of doing things,
mm-hmm.
You know, so that's. That's basically what happened to me, too, is I got an email one day and said, we've been trying to reach you at this phone number that I hadn't had in 10 years. It was a phone number I had in college, and it was the Army G1. And so I'm thinking I owed somebody money or something, you know, somebody, they messed my pay up or whatever, right? And, you know, kind of did the whole rigmarole and finally did the same kind of song and dance and, hey, there's a dignitary that needs to speak with you. And I'm still in the Army, so a colonel called me, and she says, you know, we need to set up a phone call for a high-ranking DOD official, is how she put it. And I said, well, I mean, you know, okay, because what am I going to say, no? You know, I'm still in the military. I have to say yes, so, and you're free to call me whenever you want. And I didn't even think about it. It was something that hadn't crossed my mind. It was not something, you know, I thought about every day or whatever. And then, you know, all of a sudden it's 10 years later, it's back in the forefront. So I can't even imagine what that's like in your situation where it's 44 years later,
yeah.
You know, you're hearing from President Obama, and it's I could only assume it's a flood of, you know, different emotions coming up at all at the same time because it's
well, I think it. I think the most would be the same as 1 year, like 10 years.
That's true. Yeah, maybe.
You don't really expect that.
Yeah, no, yeah. You don't.
They're not, like you said, they don't. We're doing things. They're just not going to let you know right out. Well, this is what we're going to do.
That's right. Yeah. No. And you had to wait. Yeah, I had to wait. I don't know. I think about a year. I actually asked to hold off for a little while because I had a. I was a team sergeant, and we were doing a trip to Africa, and I really, you know, I was like, I'm doing this deployment to Africa. We'll talk when I get back. And they let that happen, so I was happy about
you're
that.
Lucky. Yeah.
But no, it's it's always an interesting story. Anyway. Anything else you got? I mean, any kind of thoughts, words of wisdom for the young guys that are probably gonna be listening to this and you know, knowing what we're dealing with and where we're headed and things you've seen?
You know, if you want it, volunteer for it. But, you know, when I'm out here, I tell people, you got to love what you're doing, and you got to do what you love. There's no other way. There's no separation.
Yeah.
And take on the hard tasks. Quit looking for the easy way out. You know, and... You know, we live, like SF, we live off of volunteers.
That's right, yeah.
And we need volunteers. We need the people that are willing to commit. And it's going to get harder. SF is hard. It's hard. It scares me to even think about SF now. You know, during my time. And so I'm very proud of everybody that wears the Green Beret. And... keep bringing them in for us because we need to help.
We do. That's 100% correct. We, you know, like I said, we need people and we need, you know, people that want to come in and do this job.
That's right.
This job's changing all the time, but like I said, you know, studying your history, understanding what you guys came through is what you're going to see again in the future, in my opinion. So I think it's extremely important to understand that, you know. I think that's one of the biggest driving factors for everything we do is we can't get too far away from where we came from.
That's right.
You know, but that's where we'll end up one day. So, anything else?
No, I just say every soldier qualified himself that wears the Green Beret is my hero.
Well, I appreciate that.
Everyone. Yes.
I'd have to tend to agree. I think you know I've met some amazing folks and had some amazing opportunities in this community. I'm thankful for every one of those, you know.
And, exactly.
You know, again, like I said, this has been an outstanding opportunity in itself, and I'm happy that, you know, they let me come down here and spend some time with you.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to meet you, and I'm happy, well, since I knew your buddy, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Recipient. Yeah, we got along well. We worked together quite a bit. And I met his whole family, his kids.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and we miss him.
Oh, yeah, me too.
But just another great SF soldier.
Well, I appreciate it, yeah. Now, Ron was one of a kind for sure. He definitely made his mark. I know he made his mark on society for the short time he was around.
This has been The Indigenous Approach. We hope you have enjoyed this episode. If you want to learn more about Sergeant Major Williams or Sergeant First Class Retired Morris, there are links in the show notes, or you can go to army.mil/Medal of Honor or rsoft-history.org. Thank you for listening.